Hello, welcome to TCJ Talkies. This is the podcast hosted by me, Mike Dawson, and it lives on the Comics Journal. And on this podcast, I bring on other cartoonists to talk about books written by even other cartoonists, like a book club. This episode, I'm bringing on the cartoonist Julia Wirtz, who's a very well-known autobiographical cartoonist for her books The Fart Party, Volumes 1 and 2, The Infinite Wait, and Drinking at the Movies, as well as a bunch of online comics that are really great. And she's coming on to talk to me about two books. Roz Chast's new memoir, published by Bloomsbury USA, or just Bloomsbury, called Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant, which is a autobiographical story about her parents, her elderly parents, growing old and dying. And Joe Matt's book Spent, which was published, I think, in 2007 by Drawn Quarterly, and is also a huge downer. Also, kind of a divisive book. A lot of people, I'm not sure, I get the impression people, I love this book. I've always sort of liked it. I always, when I say in the interview, I sort of feel it's the last word on sad sack male cartoonist masturbation comics. Like, literally the last word on it and best word on it. Takes you as far down to the darknesses that sort of path naturally leads you towards. This is something I wanted to mention in the conversation with Julia. I forgot to bring it up. But I do love how essentially the book just grinds to a phoned in halt. It feels, I thought this at the time, and Julia and I talk about this, like it just sort of feels like it just stopped. As far as I know, Joe Matt never drew any other comics, or if he has, they've not been published. And the book ends with a cat shitting on him. And that's the end. That's the end of Joe Matt's cartooning career for now. So I enjoy the conversation. We relate the two books together, talk about autobiography and all sorts of stuff. It was a lot of fun. So thank you, Julia, for coming on. Let's get to the interview. Although, don't forget to follow me on Twitter, Mike_Dawes. And also, if you're on Tumblr, follow me on Tumblr at MikeDawson.com. It's Tumblr.com. It's three W's. Anyway, here's a conversation with Julia.
So we've established that I have a rudimentary understanding of the books, and I don't listen to podcasts.
Welcome to the show. So glad to have you on.
Thanks for having me. I'm sure you regret it already.
So the first thing, we're talking about two books. It's happening now. The show is happening now, just so you...
Okay, I'm ready.
Tell from the change of tone of my voice, but okay.
Two octaves.
I wrote down the note. So we're going to talk about two books, which this podcast that I'm very, very gradually getting momentum going on. So far, I've had one guest on just to talk about one book for an entire episode, but this time I have Julia Wirtz joining me here in TCJ Talkies, living room. And we're going to talk about Roz Chast's Can We Talk About Something More Pleasant? And Joe Matt's Spent. So welcome, Julia. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
And you actually requested the Roz Chast book, right?
I did, mostly because I wanted to feel like I had a justified reason for paying full price for it.
Okay.
Yeah. But also because I love her. But that too. I wanted to buy it, but I didn't want to. I needed a reason.
Okay, so it was fortuitous that I got in touch and gave you a reason to read the book.
Yeah, I can write off on my taxes. I said as if I pay my taxes.
The IRS is known to listen to my show, so you should be careful. What did you think? Maybe what we should do is just describe the book a little bit. Do you want to go?
Do you want me to do that, or do you want to do that?
You can go ahead and sort of start, and then I'll probably interrupt.
Right, so it's her dealing with her two elderly parents living almost to 100, and then, you know, the process of putting them in a retirement home? Is that what they're calling them?
Yeah, she moves her parents into, like, an assisted living home, retirement home.
Right, it's basically, you know, the timeline of them being old and falling to decrepitude and then eventually dying, which is not a spoiler alert or anything, that's literally what it is, so it's. Yeah, I mean, it's just basically her taking care of her parents and then them dying and then all the other stuff that she's kind of thinking around that situation during that time.
Do you think of this as
I don't know. Do you think of it like as a narrative? Like, it has an arc, right? There's a narrative to it, like a pretty strong one, right?
Yeah, I don't think it's a traditional one. I mean, which is one of my favorite thing about comics. I think I didn't notice that it wasn't traditional until I read people's reviews on Amazon, which is always the best place to go to get just like the general population of people who don't know how to read, like what they're thinking about books.
Okay. Is that what you did for research for the show? You were...
Yes, I've been on, I didn't even read the book. I just read Amazon. I don't even know. I didn't mean to start with the Amazon review thing right away, but they're amazing because first of all, people don't know what they're reviewing. So everyone's leaving one star because the Kindle version is hard to read.
Oh, I bet it is. Yeah.
Like, poor Ra's Chest, that's not even the book. You know, like, her only negative reviews are people who are like, well, I couldn't read the format, and, you know, iPad is weird, whatever. But so it's not even about the book. Or it's people who were looking for, like, a self-help book, kind of, for the situation.
Okay.
And we're looking for answers or something, or some sort of, like, pedantic textbook about how to deal with your dying parents, which it's not. And so I think that those people were, you know, crying foul over the fact that there wasn't a traditional narrative. But I thought there was. You're introduced to her parents, and then the story unfolds a little untraditionally. Like, she doesn't even introduce her childhood experiences with her parents until maybe the last one-third of the book.
Yeah. I thought that was sort of interesting, because, like, yeah, so the story is, hey, she introduces her parents, they're old. That's the story. They're old.
Yeah.
But they gradually, you know, she has this one thing I've been thinking about a lot, but about, like, once you hit 90, your decline is this rapid decline. And so basically her parents, they get past this age, and then they get put into a home, and gradually her father dies, and then her mother dies. What was I going to say? I'm sorry.
Not introducing the childhood stories.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because I actually thought that was sort of interesting, like... Did you feel like reading it? Because, like, so the story is them going to the retirement home and dying. But there is this sort of aspect of her childhood that, as you said, it doesn't come up until the end. And I sort of felt that was weird. Like, it's sort of like almost like that's actually the plot, is this sort of slow reveal of, like, the relationship between her and her mother.
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was great the way she did it because, like traditionally you would start there. And, you know, introduce the dynamic between her mother and her father. But she just sort of let it unfold in a really, in probably in the way she was thinking about it a lot. You know, like, you can tell there's a lot of tenderness towards her father, even though she's frustrated with him.
Yeah.
And then once, after he dies, she's left with her mother, who she has a contentious relationship with. You can tell that there's not, you know, there's not the relationship she wanted. There's not the love there that she wanted. And she doesn't try and force it or sugarcoat it. And then she just kind of talks about her childhood in a very delayed, but a way where, I don't know, it's kind of, she just drops it in there towards the end, but I think it comes at a better time towards the end when you've already sort of seen the way they interact together.
Yeah. Well, so, like, because in the beginning it kind of misleads you into thinking that, like, you know, she kind of initially presents her parents as, like, this sort of wacky couple, in a way.
Yeah, and, like, the whole codependent thing is very charming, you know, where she's calling them out on being codependent, and they're like, of course we are. And you're like, oh, they're just a lovable old couple. And then slowly you start to see that they're very flawed.
Yeah. So do you think that she's, that she was kind of, like, figuring it out then as she went? Did it read that way to you? Like, is somebody kind of, like, sort of trying to, like, figure out her own relationship with her parents, kind of, like, by doing the book?
I actually kind of get the feeling she already knew. It's something she's been working on for a while, you get the idea of. Because it doesn't really seem like she has any great epiphany regarding it. She kind of just states it, you know, like, this is how it is. And then, you know, she has that conversation with her mother, and it's not some, like, great closure kind of thing, which is very real, I think. But I think that, I don't know, it's kind of, I mean, obviously I can't step in and say, oh, of course, it's very obvious that she, you know, was having these realizations during that time or had it before. But it seems like she kind of had already figured out the relationship dynamic, so she wasn't trying to force it down the reader's throat, but she also wasn't trying to ignore it.
Yeah. It sort of surprised me a little bit, though, because it does sort of, yeah, like, on my first read, like, I wasn't expecting, you know, I wasn't reading it at first like the relationship was bad between her and her mother. But when I gave it a second read, I actually could sort of see the undertones a lot more clearly, like kind of like earlier on. Like,
yeah, when she talks about her mother's anger too, it's much less charming the second time around. Realize how she's kind of a very domineering woman.
Well, I wonder if, like, because I'm not that familiar with her cartooning, that I might have come to this, like, because I know that she's in The New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
But I've not read that many comics of hers, and I sort of maybe I thought that it was going to be more humorous. Like, so maybe that's why I wasn't seeing it the first time around.
Oh, I thought there was a lot of funny stuff in there. I was cracking up. But I could see. I mean, I could see why you would think. Also, what's interesting, I actually am a huge Roz Chast fan, and I've read most of her work, and it's funny to see, like, even the New York Times review, people can't really get away from that, like, the one panel gags that she does. Like, they can't quite work with her doing a long format. Like, in the New York Times review, the only sample that they use in the review is basically can be read as one panel, and it's all about how she's has a lot of anxiety. Like, dealing with anxiety is what like the basis of all her comics.
Okay.
Neuroses and anxiety. And they just sample this two little panel thing that's like classic Roz Chast, and it sort of ignores the entire long format that she did, which I think she's really good at, actually, but that's not her thing. So I think that a lot of people didn't really know how to read it or what to expect from it because of that. And I mean, even in that review, I just read it before we started talking about it. They don't know what to do with the entire book. They basically just lay out the plot in the whole review, and then are like, "I could relate to this." That's it. Like they don't really even talk about anything that we were just talking about how she handled the storyline or anything.
Has she written long form material before? Do you know that you're saying she did?
She does mostly just 1-4 panel kind of stuff. I don't think I've ever read any long narrative by her before, unless I don't have all of her books, but I have most of them. So usually, yeah, it's usually just a one panel sort of, the plight of human existence as seen through a very anxious personality.
Yeah, then the anxiousness comes through in this story, too. Like, she talks a lot about her father's sort of, debilitating, levels of, anxiousness and inability to sort of cope with, just regular things.
Yeah.
And then you're sort of seeing her having a lot of the same problems. Like, she doesn't know how to drive a car. She does know how to drive it, but she's a nervous driver, right?
Yeah, she knows, but she, is nervous about it. It's interesting because you can see her taking the anxiety from her father, but not the calmness that he kind of seems to have, but then the energy that her mom has, and it seems like that's where she got those from.
So it's like writing as an autobiographical story, like she's sort of, the stuff about her, herself, kind of just sort of bleeds in a little bit. Like she doesn't really, talk about herself too much.
Yeah, which I think was a good move, though, because it wasn't about her, it was about her dynamic with her parents. It was about a topic nobody ever talks about, hence the title, because it's so unpleasant, and it's not, I could see under different, it would be bad material under most people's, if just a regular writing style. I think the comic format served it well, but I lost my train of thought completely because it's raining so hard outside right now.
You actually brought up something I wanted to bring up, because that was, when I started reading the book, that was one thing I thought about. Like, I'm like, well, I like this by default, just because it's covering a topic that doesn't get covered that much.
Right.
Though, was it Joyce Farmer's Special Exits graphic novel that Fantagraphics put out a couple years ago?
Uh-huh.
2 years ago, I guess, also sort of dealt with this, sort of being like an elderly child of, an older child of elderly parents who are slowly dying.
If you only think of one book that reference, that covers a subject, that means it's like virtually uncovered.
Well, no, the thing is, I really like both those books.
Yeah.
I don't know if I want everyone to start moving into this area. They're like, let's all.
No, I don't. I think it should remain sparsely covered for that reason. Oh, we've been talking about the autobio aspect of it, how she stepped back from it, kind of,
mm-hmm.
I would say. But I think it was a good move not to overly insert herself into it, because it wasn't about her.
Well, can I bring up Joe Matt's book a little bit, or?
Yes.
Because that's, like, so that's, the two books sort of go together well in that they're both autobiography.
And unpleasant subjects.
Yeah. Do you like the Joe Mapp book? I specifically wanted to talk about it with a lady.
I do. That was a well-timed cough. No, I do like it. I have issues with it. But I almost like it because I have issues with it. And I think that it is, they do go hand in hand in the fact that I think both those books are widely misunderstood by the general. I mean, Roz Chast's book was very well received, but I think a lot of people misunderstood the intention of it. And I think a lot of people misunderstand the intention of Spent. I think, you know, they're looking for something else, basically.
So, yeah. So the other book we're talking about is Joe Matt's Spent, which was. Are you there?
Yes.
Sorry, I thought. Okay. Sorry. Joe Matt Spent, which was a collection of four issues of his series Peep Show, and this is a story which is essentially just him. In it's told in four chapters, and they're very, very like very contained, small. Like the environments are small in each of the chapters. Like it, you know, it doesn't expand very far into like a wider world. And it's like essentially just Joe Matt talking.
Right, it's like him talking to his friends in a diner, and then him jerking off in his apartment.
Yeah, and it is an incredibly unpleasant book. Did you like it at the time when it first came out?
I did, but I don't think that I appreciated it for how unpleasant it is until later. I'm not really sure why I had a change. Like I think I when I first read it, it was a long time ago it came out, right?
Yeah, so I was like super into Joe Bat, like during when Peep Show was being published. And this book came out, I think, in like 2000. I got it right in front of me, so I have it signed. I got it signed at Mocha in 2007. I was so excited because Joe Matt signed my book. Though he does actually talk in the fourth chapter about how all his friends are sad, losery men.
Yeah, but that's sort of the go-to narrative for male cartoonists.
Yeah, so I'm like, oh, Joe Matt, I love you. You're so great. So it came out 2007. And like you said, yeah, it's essentially a story about him, like, you know, dealing with, like, a masturbation addiction, a pornography addiction. But also, I sort of feel like, well, what do you feel like is the story of the book?
Well, I feel like the story is how it completely stalled his life out, how that's all he did. And it was an all-consuming, it was beyond a habit. It was a complete obsession that, he talks about how many years he spent doing it. And then it went on for, like, another decade, because I think I told you I emailed him and I asked him, like, for some extra thoughts on the book, and it kept on going for a lot longer even after the book.
What do you mean, what kept on going? Like, an actual addiction to pornography?
Yeah, you know how he talks about, all he does all day is dub VHS tapes?
Yeah,
so for listeners out there, he basically sits in he's living in, like, what's a boarding house kind of situation, like an RSO where you share a bathroom, but not RSOs are worse. And he's just all day taking these VCRs and then sampling the best parts of the pornography that he's watching and then collecting them all together. So he's like, oh, you know, I've got 8 hours, I've got 20 hours, but it takes him all day to do this. And then while he's doing it, he's jerking off, hence the title. And then you can't really do anything else with your life when you're stuck in that sort of pattern. So I think that, I mean, that's why it's such a bleak book.
So this is so when you spoke to him, like, I'm curious about this. So this is actually, like, it's not just like definitely he's masturbating a lot in the book, like 10 to 18 times a day or something like that he talks about.
Yeah. I'm looking for the email. I can give you a number. I hope he knows. I mean, I told him I was going to talk about it.
Well, I mean, I only met him the one time at Mocha when I was all giddy to meet him. So I don't know him personally. But I would assume that he's fairly comfortable with the topic since this is what the book is all about. So it actually goes beyond just sort of a, just like a funny comic topic. Like, and it's actually like a real issue.
Yeah, okay, let's see. Oh, I can't even look at this email. Yeah, I mean, it became like an all-consuming thing. It wasn't, you know, just like, oh, I jerk off a lot, blah, 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 but it like completely took over his life. I mean, he talks about, we told me in the email that he's got a relationship, which is helped him get out of that kind of situation, but it was like 20 years that he was doing that.
Like, so actual, like, so that's interesting. I mean, it's interesting to know, like, because I assume, like, reading it, like, some of this is sort of made up for the comic, but you're actually saying, like, it's a real thing. Because, like he spends a lot of time in one of the issues, basically, like, half the issue is just him describing the painstaking way of, like, as you said, like, editing together pornography, like, just to get, like, a few seconds where the girls are in it to, you know, to cut out the parts where a man's face shows up, you know, and, like, you know, dubbing together two VCRs. And, like, I've always sort of, like, had a soft spot for this book because I kind of feel like it's, I feel like it's, like, the last word in, like, you know, the sad sack male masturbation comics.
Well, it was, I feel like it's, yeah, it's the last time where it was acceptable, because then it did become, like, beating a dead horse, where it was so many people who liked, were like, oh, this book is awesome, or, like, this guy's just talking about, like, jerking off and doing nothing else and talking with his friends, and then they just took that topic and went running with it, and that's, I think that he gets a lot of the backlash for that, but I think that his book was one of, like, the first, not really the first to obviously talk about a dude jerking off, but that should just be kind of like, you know what, this book has no point other than to, you know, address this situation and then show these conversations with my friends.
Yeah, and I sort of felt like it kind of, like, it sort of what seemed amusing in his earlier work when he's sort of, you know, he's still misanthropic, he's still got arrested development, and he still has a pornography addiction in The Poor Bastard. Like, this is sort of, like, five, six, 10 years later, and it's sort of dragging you down to, like, basically, like the terrible end point of, like,
yeah,
that sort of...
It's like watching someone bottom out with any kind of addiction, where that's not fun anymore, it's not fun for them, it's not fun for the reader. And, I mean, I think that's why it's a good book. Here, you get... 1991 to 2010, so that's 20 years, in which he refers to it as an all-consuming activity.
So, like, does he talk about, like, he told you then this is something he's recovered from?
Yes. And he actually used the words, love conquers all. That is an honest quote from Joe Matt.
How nice.
Yeah.
I mean,
got some treatment for it. He's in a, like, a good relationship with someone who can deal with him, I guess. So, you know, apparently it's not a problem, but for 2 decades, it was that's all he did. You know, even in lieu of drawing a lot, he was saying, he talks about it in the book. Like, he's supposed to be drawing these comic books, and it's funny because he's on the phone. Is he talking to Chris at Fantagraphics when he's on the phone?
He gets Chris Olivares from Drawn Quarterly calls him in the fourth chapter.
Yeah, and then they're kind of arguing about it, and he's not doing anything because he's just jerking off all the time. That's a fun little, like, I don't know, comic nerd thing. But,
I liked that, I always felt, so when I was reading the serialized comics, when that fourth issue came out, I felt like it was phoned in. Like, it just felt like it sort of, like, gave up on the story.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, It does sort of feel like, you know, like, it's kind of like the term, the title Spent also works as, like, basically, like, this is just, like, throwing in the towel and cartooning.
Right.
Like, and, like, trying to write a story, because it just sort of, like, falls to pieces. It's essentially just him in his room for the entire last chapter, masturbating and talking about, like, how he just can't get out of this rut. And then his publisher literally calls him on the phone, which I sort of, like, it's like, gosh, exactly, like, phoning it in. just to express some, you know, exposition of, like, you know, and I'm not drawing, and you are my publisher, and I'm not delivering things to you.
Well, it was supposed to be, he said it was supposed to be 3 times longer, but then he didn't offer an explanation as to why it wasn't.
Yeah, and it definitely reads that way. Like, it reads, yeah, like, it just sort of, like, blah.
Yeah, which, again, is kind of why I like it. I mean, it's very untraditional and horrible, but, like, in a good way.
Well, so I agree with you. I like it, too. Because I've always liked it in that way. Like, I feel like it is definitely the last word on, like, a very ugly way of cartooning. And it is sort of, like, interesting in that it is clearly is sort of a failure in a way. But so does part of you dislike it for other reasons?
Well, as a woman, it's very frustrating to watch a guy get stuck in... I mean, and he doesn't really even talk about this, so it's obviously me projecting into it. But when people get stuck on pornography, which, I mean, I understand how that happens. I watch pornography from time to time. But it's such an unrealistic portrayal of women, and it's so, overall, it's very degrading. And
pornography or the
book? Watching it in that context. Pornography.
Yeah.
And so to watch somebody get, like, all consumed in something like that, and then he talks about, especially when he meets up with his friend who gives him the videos, like, they're just objectifying every single woman who walks by. And I know... And I know that that's just kind of an outcome of watching porn. I mean, I'll do that too. Like, I hope my mom doesn't listen to this. If I sit around and watch porn all day and then I go out into the real world, everyone you see then does that in your head. But if you're doing that constantly, you're never not seeing that.
Yeah.
And to know that that happens and to know there's a lot of people walking around with that exact thought process is just a little bit disconcerting.
I do sometimes. I often wonder about this as a man. there's a thing that, you know, the men objectify women, you know, sexually, but then I feel like a healthy person can compartmentalize it, maybe, like, you know.
If you're healthy, you should be being like, you know what, I'm watching porn for the pleasure of watching pornography, that's it. You know, give or take, you know, whatever. But then
I announce that before I go into my room. I am doing this.
Give or take, I'll compartmentalize when I'm done.
I will not be bringing this to the real world.
Right. Well, yeah, a healthy person's like, you know, this is a very unrealistic portrayal of human interaction. This isn't how things really are. But if you have a habit like that that's all consuming, I feel like you lose the ability to do that, to separate, you know, what's real and what's not.
Well, how much of the book do you think, like, because as I was going through it, I'm like, I feel like to a large extent, he knows how he's presenting himself. And he's trying to show himself in that sort of, like, you know, warts and all, here's every filthy thing about me, including the misogyny. Like, he very purposefully, like, you know, putting in a couple of scenes, like, where, like, he'll dismiss some woman because of a physical thing. So, like, I feel like he's an author, he's trying to, like, you know, he's in on it, he knows that, you know, what the contrast is with him whining about how women don't like him.
Self-aware.
But then I wonder, like, you know, but then is there aspects of it where, like, he wasn't self-aware enough?
I kind of get the idea, and I only because I do autobio, so I understand how easily this happens, is if you're working on something in present time or very shortly after, which he did with this, you fancy yourself very self-aware, and so you put stuff in there like that, but then you'll read the piece later and be like, oh my god, like, I had no idea what I was actually doing. And it's clear he's aware that he's got a huge problem in the book and that he's objectifying women, but I would be willing to guess that it wasn't until much later, when he's really stepped away from it, that he saw other aspects of what was going on there.
Yeah. There's a part, like, where they sort of, like, the third chapter is him and the cartoonist Seth and Chester Brown sitting in a diner, and it's just the whole chapter is just a conversation. And I feel like it's only one of the few moments where they try to say, like, oh, you should think about what life is, what things are like for women. You know, like, you know, they, you know, like, to try to be, like, sympathetic to, like, you know, what must be like for a woman. And all they throw out as examples is pregnancy and menstruation.
Yeah. First of all,
those are the two things
who do not fucking understand women at all. Like, I've read all of those guys' books.
So say that again, because that was a good. I didn't mean to cut you off. You're saying all three of them you feel don't understand women?
Yeah, I feel like having read all of their books, I feel like that's a group of men who are classic men, even though they don't think that they are. You know, I think that they are more self-aware than the average. When you think of, like, a bro, like, they're not like that, but I do think that they're stuck in a very old-fashioned gender role sort of lifestyle. And especially, it was hard to watch them talk about the objectification of women, also having read Chester Brown's book, which I have a lot of issues with, which I, again, appreciate its ugliness, but it as a woman, watching men try and fail to be sympathetic is very difficult. And I understand why it happens. It's hard to understand the opposite sex, but you would just think that they would be a little bit more advanced, I guess. But then knowing how much they ever talk about is how the past and things were better back then. And that was a time when gender was not an equal
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, like you're saying about that actually might be part of it that they're never addressing.
Yeah, and I don't think that they would necessarily come to that conclusion. And I mean, I could be drawing my own conclusion about it, but all that those guys ever talk about, I mean, especially Matt and Seth, is how things are better in the old days. And I know that they're talking about art. They're mostly talking about quality and art.
Yeah, they're talking about like vitamin bottle labels.
Yeah, I know how they're drawn better, which I totally agree with. But they do talk about, you know, just technology and communication and the way people are, and you have to assume that that sort of leaches into their you know, the philosophy that they have around gender roles, which is that women belong, you know, pregnant, menstruating, or in the kitchen kind of thing, and life was, you know, more romantic back then because they romanticized the past. And I would assume that that just kind of comes out in the way that they see women.
I was thinking about, like, you know, and I don't blame Joe Matt for this, but I think about the strain of the type of comic that was, you know, I think, I mean, Joe Matt, I think in his comics is acknowledged a big influence from Robert Crumb. And the Crumb sort of character in a lot of his work and then throughout Joe Matt's work is sort of that the angry beta male who's angry at the women for not understanding how sensitive they are. And not liking them because they're not like the jocks, but then like it all like that manifests itself in this sort of knot of anger towards, like, you know, it's sort of like a men's right of that whole MRA thing or whatever. Like the isn't this like, do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
Men's rights people, like.
Oh yeah, yeah. The whole backlash, baby, against that.
But, like, Crumb is like this, too, and this sort of, like, it's sort of a little bit, like, well, it's very much, like, sort of showing how even alternative comics who always sort of fancy themselves more highbrow,
mm-hmm.
you know, it was a sort of a man's world, like, you know, but just for nerdier people.
It is sort of like this whole take back of, you know, yeah, man being men and sort of men's world, which is, I don't know, all of those guys, like, it's hard to... I kind of appreciate them for that, but at the same time, it's gross.
Well, so there's a thing they do. Well, something I should say. I don't put myself outside of this strain. In fact, it's something like I sort of, you know, I'm unfortunately, you know, old enough that, you know, there's going to be in my DNA as a cartoonist that I'm never going to be able to shake out. Sort of the, you know, the way alternative comics were in the 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the 90s are better because they were, like, you know, a lot more women cartoonists, like, you know, becoming more prominent.
Yeah, but it was still very much the male with his hands thrust in his pocket, stomping down the street. Yes. Sort of.
Yeah, Dan Clowes is another one with
going home and jerking off.
Yes. Which, again, like, to Joe Matt's credit, I sort of feel like this is, again, like a last word. Like, it's like, we're done with this now. This is a sort of the angry, you know, beta male, you know.
Oh, spent is the last word on that. He buried it.
I hope so. I mean, I don't know if I hope so or not, but I definitely sort of feel like it did sort of, like, really, like, tackle it full on, like, the ugliness of it, like, these, you know, people. It is sort of interesting, the Seth and Chester Brown portrayal as well, because reading this, you wouldn't quite know exactly sort of how out there Chester Brown's feelings on relationships are.
No, he doesn't talk much in the book, but then he's the one who, at the end, sort of brings up the objectification of women, right?
Does he say, they both, there is a scene where they both sort of talk about, like, Seth and Chester are essentially, they're calling Joe Matt on his objectification, because Joe is complaining about, like, how he can't get, you know, exactly the type of woman he wants. Chester, the end of it is him having to go back to clean his ex-girlfriend's apartment.
Right, which, if you've read Paying for It, you know exactly the timeline where that matches up.
Yes, you can put it.
Yeah, and he kind of made Chester Brown look like not the hero of the conversation, but the more decent one.
He
but
does, he seems no decent.
Like, motherfucker, I know what he's going to go do.
I'm like, he's all right, he doesn't, you know, he's so progressive, he's going to go clean his ex-girlfriend's apartment.
Yeah.
And then have a prostitute come over.
It's definitely enhanced by knowing who all the characters in the books are.
Seth, have you read much Seth comics? Like,
I've not read all of them, but I've read some. I'm not a huge fan, but I definitely appreciate it.
Let me sort of ask a question, like, because I love, you know, I love the Toronto trio was a big thing for me. You know, Seth and Chester Brown and Joe Bat and all their comics are so, you know, were my favorites. So would you say that Roz Chast is always just sort of, like, is that something you were naturally just more interested in, do you think, than Seth and Joe Matt masturbation comics?
Well, when you put it that way. No, but there's this thing with, and this is almost only involving comics, it doesn't cross over to music and regular literature, where I'm drawn to female creators' work much so more than men. And I don't really know why, but I think that it's just, it's not even necessarily that I relate to it, but there's more of an energy to a lot of the work that the women are putting out right now, as opposed to, in my mind, a lot of the work by guys just kind of blurs into a couple of books.
Okay.
Which is a horrible thing to say, but
what do you mean? Like, when you just think of, like, men cartoonists right now, you can only think of a few, or they all just seem like the same book?
It all just kind of seems like the same book. And I'm like, of course that's not true, but I don't know why. I'm just, like, drawn to female cartoonists, to their work more, definitely more so. Like, even today someone asked me to come up with a list, and I had to sit down and, like, force myself to put a couple of guys' names in there.
Oh, how the tables have turned on us. Oh. We used to run this industry. Now it's all Emily Terrible, and, yeah.
But, yeah, I don't know, but I definitely...
No, but the thing is, I think I agree with you. I think in terms of, like, you're talking about, like, an energy and stuff like that. I don't disagree, and I'm sort of, I don't think it's a sad thing to sort of, like, I kind of think it's okay for, like, you know, this sort of, you know, for us not to be so hung up on, like, the history of alternative comics and, like, sort of, you know, insist on, like, continuity in it. Like, you know, that, like, you know, the important male cartoonist must remain the more important male cartoonist kind of thing. Like, I think that's good if it's not that way.
Yeah, well, I think that, I mean, especially when I first came on the scene, there was this, like, this need to hold on to that traditional indie comics kind of thing. Like, we're talking about the 80s and 90s, and it's definitely something that I think all cartoonists should be aware of, but the change in tone, I'm very open to it. Just because, I mean, it's the same thing with books. You don't have to have read every single great American novel or great piece of literature to create an amazing book. You should probably be aware of it, but it doesn't mean you have to follow in the same sort of path.
Yeah. Do you think that, do you think that the cartoonist Seth, like, talking about, like, sort of, like, being, self-aware, do you think that, like, because he's not really portrayed that well in a way, like, he's kind of an asshole. Like, but probably at the time, maybe it felt okay. But, like, do you think, like, he's very, very critical of his friends, but that's something I relate to as sort of seems to be a male dynamic. But he also sort of, like, as you're talking about, like, he sort of seems, like, the less decent when it comes to, like, women.
Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, that surprised me only because I expected the things that he was saying to come from Chester only, but again, that's just because you really don't. How these guys portray themselves in books, too, can also be different than how their actual conversations are.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think especially people like that who are so meticulous and, you know, all their dialogue is very thought out.
No, I'm not saying Seth is a person. I'm not saying he's
in the book,
jerk or not.
He's a total dick, though.
I'm saying, but I wonder, like, if, like, with the benefit of hindsight, does he say maybe seem like more... like, less decent. Like, he's essentially urging Joe Matt to compartmentalize. Like, basically, a lot of Joe Matt's drive, it seems, of relationships is to have something where he could be truthful. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of interesting because that's also his drive as a cartoonist. Like, you know, to, like, unearth every truth about himself.
Right, which is that's a heavy load to carry when the truth is so ugly.
Yeah, and I wonder, like, because maybe... Like, it's sort of it's funny to me that it didn't even occur to me that this is a real problem they had with pornography. Now I'm like, oh, it really is, like, an actual, like, ugly, like, thing to have to deal with. But
he talks about it, though, how he's, you know, he's getting into his early 30s in the book, I think. And he's just, like, living in this room with this landlady he's hiding from and sharing a bathroom with, like, you know, two or three other people. Yeah. And he's clearly like, this is holding me back with my life.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm living in this room and I'm okay with it, and that's a problem.
I guess it's because maybe I know people. You know, or not, I don't know anybody who's like in a Joe Matt situation, but I definitely have people I know who sort of, you know, perhaps have, you know, arrested development might be the good word for it, you know, but sort of in this skeezy kind of boy way of
well,
staying in rooms, looking at pornography and, you know, go ahead.
Going anywhere in life. But that's why I thought it was so interesting to read early on and then to read later, because I'm in my early 30s and I'm in the same kind of time frame where, I mean, it was hard for me to read again at this point because I have the same thing where I'm living in a 300-square-foot apartment that I didn't think I would still be in. Like, I moved here 7 years ago. Yeah, no, I've been in this apartment for 7 years. I only thought I was going to be here for 2 years. So while I was reading that book and he's talking about, you know, being in this weird small room that he's living in, still stuck there, and I was just like, oh, God, it's the same thing.
Well, and also I'm sorry.
I appreciated it for that aspect of it. I think maybe when you read it later, it like drives home the desperation more, or like the crisis of a situation of being stalled, you know, or being somewhere where you didn't think you would still be.
Okay, so you're saying you're sort of relating to Joe Matt's character in some regards?
Yeah.
I had written down a note that I sort of relate to Seth, because he's kind of the asshole who thinks he's got it figured out. I think he likes to talk to everybody like he's got it all sussed out. Who's kind of an asshole in that way. But I was
right. But then
curious.
You see it from the outside, and you're like, wait, they're all.
Yeah, they're all that way. There's the thing about like accumulation of things in apartments, and this sort of goes back to the Roz Chass book, because a whole segment of that book is when she's going through her parents' like stuff, and it's just like,
oh, that's such a good part where she like there's a drawer full of jam jars,
mm-hmm.
and she's like, why is there a drawer full of jam jars? Or the lids to jam jars. Anyways, yeah.
And I know that you also like to accumulate things, so.
Yeah, it's definitely. You gotta kind of be a weird people who accumulate and like can't really. It's not hoarding so much as like you just like your stuff kind of thing. But then Joe Matt has that thing where he's like a minimalist in a very weird way, where he doesn't keep anything except these comics that he collects and the porn he records.
Yeah, but those things mean a lot to him. Like, you know, those are the things like he's in his room, you know, with. Right.
With all his treasures.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know what that is.
Well, so like you like that part in there because it's actually two different sort of stages of life. You know, because the Joe Matts are like, you know, like this is where he at the moment is, you know, putting a lot of his emotions into like, you know, accumulating things in his room. But then the Roz Chass story.
Yeah, well, there's like a stage of. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I wasn't saying anything. I'm having a slight. I feel like it might be cutting out a little bit because of the storm. Are you having trouble hearing me at all?
A little bit. That came through fine, though.
Okay, it's sort of going in and out. Yeah, it's a big. We're having a big storm. But yeah, go ahead. I was just saying about like how this accumulation of things is something as a reader I just thought about, like, you know, because we're all acquiring stuff, and I don't know if you have you gone through this yet at all, like with anyone, like. When people dying and having to deal with their stuff?
I have. It is, I think about it a lot with my own collecting too. When both of my grandparents died, they were both very long, drawn out deaths, which, you know, I also kind of related to in the book. It was a little bit hard to read during that part, but then they both died within a couple of years of each other. It's left with all this garbage. Okay. Like my mom took it all too, and she put it in my old bedroom. And my brother's old room, so it's just upstairs in this weird attic area where we're slept. And it's just like piles and piles of plates and old vacuum cleaners and a computer from like the first computer ever. And she doesn't get rid of it. And I have to go and look at it when I stay there. I have to like wade through all this like piles of shit to get to the bed. And then Like, fuck that. I'm going to burn that house down. I'm not dealing with that. That's, like, too much. I don't know what
that's what you're officially
people
declaring.
Just can't get rid of stuff that's useless. But it's, I mean, in Joe Matt's comic, I think you see the early stages of the collecting of the stuff and how much it means to you at that point. And then, alternatively, in Ross Chast's books, you see how it becomes this a burden to other people.
Yeah.
And the collecting of stuff stops meaning anything, I think, especially in your later years, where it's just, like, just stuff you can't deal with, kind of, because you probably know you're going to die soon, and it's just, like, it's never the day you're going to clean out. You know, they have the crazy closet in the book.
Yeah.
It's never the day you're going to clean out. And my mom has that, too. She's got the whole upstairs, where we've got this junk drawer with this armoire. And it's just never the day that stuff's going to get clean. And that day comes when someone dies.
And then that's when you get into the junk drawer and pull out all the...
And you're like, the fuck is all this stuff? Like, where did it even come from?
And you're in a bad emotional state. And you're like, I need to hold on to these vacuum cleaners.
Yeah, and it just keeps getting passed down and down and down until finally someone's like, no more. You know, I'm not taking any of this stuff. And obviously, that's not going to be me. I'm not going to have the... I love stuff, so I don't know. I'll get rid of all the dishes and vacuum cleaners, but I'm sure that I'll freak out and want to keep a lot of it too, so it's never going to end. It's an endless cycle of stuff that doesn't mean anything.
So Joe Matt's heirs one day are going to be like, what are all these piles of Bird's Eye Bristow Center clippings, you know, that I've inherited?
At least they won't be able to play the VHS because there'll be no VCRs left anywhere.
That's true. Yeah. We're like, and I don't know what's on these tapes, but you know, giant stack of tapes. What did you think? Just a couple other questions. Like, do you like the format of the Ross Chast book?
I thought it was a little bit text heavy at times. I understand why she wrote it out, just because she had a lot to say at certain points. But it's kind of it's jarring to go from an image, but then just to a page of all writing. But I also kind of like it because it's untraditional like that, so I'm not really sure.
I think it actually works well, but it sort of makes me think a little bit of what you're talking about, like sort of, you know, how the comics tradition is sort of changing a little. Like, the idea that a comic needs to be like the Joe Matt comic, which is, you know, that's a very rigid grid, and it's obviously like,
yeah,
if somebody comes from a school of, like, cartooning is done a certain way.
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't break from that at all.
But I think about this a bit, like, these days as I'm making my own comics. Like, this whole idea, like, you know, it doesn't have to be a certain way. Like, you can just, like, put in a whole lot of text. Like, if it just, you know, if it conveys the story, right?
Yeah, and she also has, like, one page that can stand alone completely. Like, little anecdotes about her mom or her dad.
Yeah.
That are really funny. And on their own, they stand there fine, and then she'll break it. The thing is, I've thought of changing a lot, like, doing that kind of stuff, too. And I even had a short story I'd done where I'd done a lot of text, and I was like, this is great, I can do whatever I want. But then when I see it happening sometimes in other people's books, I'm not ready for two pages of handwritten text.
Okay.
But I think that's just... it was fine when I was reading it in the book, but it's I don't know.
It did work, yeah, because you did the story that went up recently about, like, having to do with, like, stepping out of comics, right, and dealing with...
was half text, half writing... and then half image. That was a whole mishmash of things. And again, you know, I was like, I'm doing it. It's fine. It's great. I can do whatever I want. But then sometimes when I see it in another way, it's just surprising.
You see it, you prefer people to be putting in their panel borders and using that blue line pencil paper that Marvel Comics used to use.
No. Don't get me wrong. I love the wackier format, much more leaning towards that. Yeah, just because it's not, you know, like we've said before, the great thing about the new kind of way the indie comics are being done is they're very outside of the box. Pardon the pun.
Whatever.
But that they are like that. They're just kind of like whatever the writer wants to do, they do it.
Yeah. One thing I didn't like that much about it, I don't really like the size, and I don't like the hardcover. But I sort of feel like this is sort of a trend in comics, like, towards making these sort of, like, hardcovers, like, these big things. That I don't love.
I don't know. I don't give two fucks if a book has a hardcover or French flaps or not. It looks nice, but at the end, it's just, it doesn't mean anything.
Well, this is me and my feeling that, you know, underground comics should remain, you know, these seedy little...
You're like, zines forever!
They should be zines, yes. you know, I mean, I don't know, but they, you know, I kind of feel like the Joe Matt book was sort of like came at a moment when I guess Drawn Quarterly was sort of like one of the ones who were kind of like pushing us into this format of like hardcovers.
Yeah, that's a hard. That's like a fancy hardcover with a cloth bound thing, right?
Yeah, and I feel like that was a like they didn't used to do that, and then at this period in the mid aughts, like is when they started like you know a whole bunch of these sort of like yeah, it's like the cloth bound canvasy feeling covers. And I think it actually probably helps people buy the book because it, you know.
It looks nice. I appreciate, like, a good-looking book that's hefty, too, and won't fall apart. But like I said, I really don't care what format a book appears in. Like, it doesn't change my opinion of what I'm reading.
Yeah. No, I didn't read really. I mean, although, I'm not sure. I could definitely, could almost. Like, I saw someone once say that if Chester Brown's paying for it, had been like this like ratty little paperback that you like found somewhere like on a spinner rack or something, mm-hmm. you know, that it would have read a bit better because it comes out in this very prestige format, like New York Times bestseller.
That's true. I wonder if I would have been kinder to it.
Like if you thought it was just some crazy outsider artist. You just like stumbled across in the back of
the like, this is amazing. This look at this weird shit they're talking. Always talking prostitutes. It's wonderful.
This guy's a lunatic. He's against romantic love.
Oh, it's so real. Like objectifying women. He doesn't care at all.
But do you think that maybe that would be the case? That maybe because part of what is annoying about that book is that it's sort of you know very promoted in a sort of you know best New York Times bestseller kind of way, like prestigious. Sure.
Yeah, when anything's presented with, you know, in a pretentious manner like that, I'm instantly a little bit against it. And it is probably because of what we were saying, where, you know, there's a whole thing where, like, underground comics should be kind of gritty and they should kind of stay that way. But, I mean, I feel like...
I mean, you are right. Like, you shouldn't let it affect how you feel about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, but no, I hadn't thought of that at all, actually, in the way that I'm just, like, rethinking the way I might have seen paying for it had it been presented to me differently. Because I am irked by the prestige that surrounds that book, and I think that I let it negatively affect the way I read it.
I feel like, I know technically we're supposed to be talking about Joe Matt and Ross Chaz, but I'm not sure that, I think, doesn't everybody basically feel that paying for it is like I mean some people like it, some people don't like it, but then they all like does anybody think that it's not like kind of crazy and you know all the things that people think about it? Good articulation, Mike. Wonderful interview.
Yeah. Let me reassemble those words in my head.
I was like, I don't know that many people who are like, oh yes, I love that book. I feel like this book was more provocative. Like it was like something that was you know, we were all riled up about in what, 2011 kind of, or something.
Yeah, I felt it was a little bit, but I also, so on the other hand, thought it was overly praised for being so honest and such like a, you know, it was kind of a masterpiece. I think a lot of people, maybe at first, I think a lot of people were like afraid to tip the holy cow, but then it was done and then there was kind of just a big fallout from it. Where people are like, well, yeah, we can talk shit about this book.
I mean, that might be true, because I remember reading it, and then I started, you know, looking around on Twitter, people are sort of generally like, I don't know, you know, but,
yeah, well, that's
but most people are like, oh, I'm so excited about New Chester Brown, amazing, amazing.
Yeah, exactly, and everyone's like, oh, it's so good, and they were afraid to, I mean, the same, any book that's presented like that, like Habibi was presented like that, I think, and you could tell that no one wanted to talk bad about it at first, and then, you know, someone did, and then it kind of, people felt more openly, like they could criticize it, and it was okay.
Like, oh, thank God.
But, yeah, I was like, oh, phew. But, I mean, and I think that is, like, a direct result of books being presented in a very fancy manner.
There's did you ever read that, Dan Clowes book, Wilson?
Yeah. That was another one that people were like, oh, it's so good. And then as soon as someone was like, this was a mess, everyone was like, yes, it was.
Well, that one I kind of love. It's all having to do with, like, you know, I have a love for that one because I sort of feel like Dan Clowes has the ability and the opportunity to give, like, the New York Times readers what they want.
Mm-hmm.
Like he wrote David Boring, which I thought was a great book. And, you know, that's what, like, these coffee table people want. in their prestigious Pantheon hardcovers, you know, a story like that. And then essentially Wilson comes out, and I do think that, yeah, everyone's appraising it because no one wants to be the one to say, like, this book isn't, you know, is what is this book? But I kind of love it in that, like, it's essentially like Needle Dick the bug fucker, like, given to the Pantheon audience, like, here, this is Underground Comics.
Yeah.
Here is this awful misanthrope. Kind
of subversive in that way, almost, where you're like, oh, he gets a good prank.
Yes, he did. He punked.
Yeah.
The readers of, the Pantheon readers, the people who just buy those books because they're told that this is a good book.
Right.
Because nobody reads these things anyway. None of those readers are going home and cracking open their graphic novels.
No, they put it on their graphic novel section of their shelf, and they're like, yes, I read graphic novels because NPR said I should.
Yes, these are very in right now. But yeah, Wilson is like this ugliest book. It's not ugly physically, but like the character. Like,
yeah, yeah.
I haven't read that one in a while. I'm going to do a Dan Clowes discussion in a couple episodes, but yeah. I don't know why I didn't plug that.
Yeah, who are you going to have talk about that one?
I believe I'm going to have Jim Rugg come on to talk about a Dan Clowes book.
Oh, I can't wait to hear him shit talk something. He's such a...
He's angry. He says it how it is.
All right. I'll listen to that one.
All right, so do you have anything else to say about these two books?
I just wanted to... There was one part in the Roz Chass book that I think about all the time. Which she's talking about how her parents, when they're at the old folks, the retirement center, and her dad's got dementia, and her mom was like, "Your father was walking around with an egg in his pocket all day. Like, thank God it was hard boiled." And it's such a funny situation, but it's so tragic. And I thought that like that one panel sort of like encapsulated the whole thing.
Yeah,
we're just like, oh God, like that's so depressing to think of an old guy walking around with a fucking egg in his pocket.
That's
what being old is.
That is like being old, though, I guess, right? Like, it's sort of a blessing and a curse, like parents who live to like old age like that. Because, you know, we'd all be so lucky to have our parents live that long. But then, you know, it doesn't seem, as she says, like you think people just die quietly in their sleep one night. But that isn't like, you know, how it goes for a lot of people. You know, it's like years of like indignity and, you know.
Yeah, and being a burden on your loved ones. Like, she's very cold at times, which I think is, you know, the most honest portrayal of it, where she's just like, there's no money left for me, and I'm irritated, and I don't want to go to Brooklyn, and, you know, that's how people actually feel in those kind of situations. You're putting everyone out when you're living that long. Just don't do it.
As a writer of autobiography, she's not necessarily, like her stuff, you say, has to deal with anxiety, but it's not necessarily...
It's a thinly veiled autobio kind of stuff.
But I always do sort of wonder, like, you know, there is the aspect of liberation that comes from, as grim as it is, from, you know, your family members not being around anymore. That, you know, you wouldn't be able to write a book like this saying, I didn't get along with my mother at all.
Oh, yeah, no, it's definitely, there's a freedom gained with your loved ones dying.
So as writers, not as human beings.
All day.
Well, I mean, sort of, I always wanted to think about Art Spiegelman, because he's very brutal on sort of like how he deals with his parents and Mouse.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, he has no immediate family. You know, like, they're dead.
Yeah, you get to say whatever you want.
You know, so he can be as brutal and just, like, you know, talk about them that way. Where, you know. I don't know, so we all have that to look forward to. The liberation that comes with dead families. That's when the good books are going to come out.
Tell you all my true feelings now. Yes. In my zine.
Yes. Well, I hope that was fun. I enjoyed that. And it was good to talk to you.
Yeah, good to talk to you too.